This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show number 166. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com. You can call us on
020-88-167-691.
And you can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
My name's David Hinchliff, and this week I'm joined by Mark Garraway and Berners. So this week it's all happening. There's one day cricket going on. There's 2020 cricket going on. There's IPL news, and of course there's the forever expanding list of coaching questions that we've got to get through. So are we all ready this week, Berners, Garris?
Ready to go, mate.
Absolutely, firing on all cylinders.
So this week we had an interesting. A statement from one of the finest spin bowlers to have played in recent times, Muthurathan, who said that English 2020 cricket is all out of date because it's not a franchise system. So that led me to thinking, I wonder how the franchise system has any effect on players. Does it at all? Is it one of those things where it just seems a bit out of date because, you know, county cricket has got a long-standing tradition, and actually, to the players, it doesn't make any difference. They just go out on the park and give the ball a biff and try and bowl Yorkers. What do you think, Gareth?
I'm going to ask a question for against the question here. Did he actually substantiate this statement of his? Was there any detail in it, or did he just decide to get on his soapbox and say one thing and then get off it again?
Yeah, pretty much. He's over in England, isn't he? Playing for Gloucester this year.
Yeah.
And he said, they introduced it worldwide, but now England is old-fashioned. They need to change and become franchise teams, and each county would benefit financially. If it happens like that, it would be huge in England. I think the market is there, and the TV rights will come. So, I mean, he's looking at it from a money point of view. He's saying it's all about the cash, but I'm looking at it from a player's point of view. Do the players really care?
What, about cash, yeah? Definitely. I would say that, you know, having heard what he's just mentioned there in terms of the commercial element of it, the commercial element, it's a great product. We know that. And it's been a great product in county cricket for a number of years. What I think he's trying to say is that in the way that the Big Bash has operated, in the way that the IPL has obviously operated, it can create a lot more money, which in turn can do a lot more things for county cricket. So rather than it just being about him being paid more money or other players being paid more money, I think he's looking at the generation of extra cash in terms of having lots more sponsors on his shirts, in terms of maybe having fewer teams playing in it that then can raise cash that goes back into the full 18 counties. All of those sort of things can happen, and it is the commerciality of it.
Do you think it would make a difference to standards? Playing standards.
Well, I mean, it all depends on whether he means, because he doesn't really say that. If he means a reduction in the amount of teams that are playing, because obviously there's 18 playing as opposed to the 9 that play in the IPL now and 10 in the previous year. So having a reduction in the number of teams would obviously increase the quality, because you'd have all the better players playing and you know, less teams. So yeah, that's the way that will work, in the same way as Premier Leagues have done that in club cricket. You know, reducing to eight top team Premier Leagues or whatever the case may be reduces the teams, which increases the concentration of talent.
I think you've also got to consider that a lot of these people who pass comment are not English. So they probably, like you say, the tradition and all that side of things, they look at it and think, well, this doesn't add up quite as I see it. But then, you know, like you say, disbanding counties is, you know, that's almost like ripping someone's heart out, isn't it, in English cricket, and saying, oh, well, no, you're playing as Bristol now, or you're playing as Taunton.
And yeah.
And all the rest of it. So
absolutely, mate. That's been the point, isn't it? Because he's not the first person to say that they could be less teams. If that's what he's saying, which I can only assume that it is. And that, you know, that's been muted heaps of times, and it's like turkeys voting for Christmas, isn't it, really?
Yeah, and when you look at it from the coalface, I mean, what county cricket has done to the game of cricket in the world, you look at, you know, that successful West Indian side of yesteryear, where they had those fast bowlers, Viv Richards, the likes of those guys, they all played in county cricket. That's why they were so good. was that we allowed them to play, we allowed them to develop their skills in different circumstances with great players and playing more frequently, and created that platform for basically a lot of these players and a lot of these teams to actually gravitate into what they were, and we still do that now.
And we've also seen the influence of that franchise system at grassroots level in India. Of course, we've talked about the Delhi Premier League before on the show, the under nines up to under 17s regional league, which is based on the idea of the IPL, a franchise system, which used Pitch Vision to select players for different franchises. So do we think that using that system is going to make difference to player development?
It should do. You know, it's a new concept, isn't it? So I think we have to wait and see in terms of the logic that sits behind it. Yeah, it should make a positive impact on player development, because you'll get people being put into teams for specific roles. And because, you know, I look at our school team at the moment, we've got we're a bit limited on batting, so it's a case of making up as many runs as we possibly can. Everybody's an all-rounder, and also we've got nine people at a frontline bowlers, and you know, within a school, it's tough to balance everybody getting the proper experience that they can from each game of cricket. Whereas in the DPL, you're able to distribute your players more evenly, so everybody gets a better game, which in turn helps player development. So, in theory, I think it's going to work. The proof will be of the pudding to be in the eating, obviously, and we wait to see how it goes. But there's nothing that says to me at the moment, from a concept point of view, that it won't work.
Perez, would you like to play in a franchise?
I'd love it, mate. I'd absolutely love it. Colours, girls, flashing lights. 30,000 spectators coming in to watch me play.
They'd be cramming them in at Ealing to get 30,000 in.
Oh, mate, Corfordham Road, fortress, you know. A couple of season ticket holders down there. Relish the opportunity to watch young Berners at the crease.
I thought you'd retired. You sent me an email earlier in the week saying you've retired.
No, we won't talk about that just yet, but it's very disappointing. It's very disappointing. I got to Hump Wednesday, or Hump Thursday, as they call it. And I think I'll play again this Saturday. I often do that. 4 days just to reflect. And I've come out of retirement, and I think I'll try again.
The trick is to make the eBay auction of your bat end on the Friday, so you've got time to change your mind.
Yeah, that's it. Don't put it on the bonfire just yet.
Or something else, incidentally, Gareth, while we're chatting about things, a bit of wicketkeeper talk, which is probably going to turn off about 90% of the listeners. so give us 5 minutes, Gareth, we'll just talk between ourselves. I heard somebody just mention briefly on the radio that there's a trend in 2020 for wicketkeepers to take off their gloves. And
it's illegal.
To take off their gloves.
Yeah. Now I don't know, because it was just mentioned in the briefest moment, something about taking off the glove of the last ball so you can you can more accurately throw at the stumps or something like that.
It's legal.
You come across that?
No.
Okay. This may have just been radio talk.
Yeah. I think it might be a bit of padding going on there. I would suggest. I mean, obviously, one of the things that you do practice with top level wicketkeepers is to get them to get used to throwing, both with and without their glove. And the ability to get your glove off quickly is obviously important, particularly when you're standing up to the stumps and say you've got everybody back on the circle and the batter drops one in front of himself and goes for a run. It's something that if you watch Matt Prior keeping wicket, he does it very, very well. And way back in the day, probably the best person at doing it was a guy called Keith Piper, who kept wicket for yeah. Warwickshire. Was fantastic getting his glove off and got a number of runouts. And we'd often compete against each other to see how many runouts we could get over the course of a summer doing exactly that. And he had the most extravagant glove flick that I saw. This glove used to disappear miles up into the air and go a good distance. So I certainly didn't have as good a glove flick as him, but we used to compete hard to get those to run out. So yeah, I mean, if they're referring to that, then I understand that it's important to be able to get the glove off. But trying to preempt the run out and getting the glove off beforehand, whether it's illegal or not illegal, is flawed, I would suggest.
Here's one for you boys. Last over of a T20 game.
Yeah.
Five runs required. Keeper misses it. bit of a scuffle, goes down to the boundary behind him. Mm. He throws his gloves off, goes charging after the ball, puts the dive in. Fielder's gone to the stumps, put his gloves on. He's thrown into the guy now wearing the gloves. Oh. 5 penalty runs, lost the game.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
What on earth was a fielder doing? I mean, is this a real story or is this just something that you've dreamt up?
Real story.
Well,
12-year-old.
12-year-old.
Schoolboy error.
Well,
literally.
Exactly.
Classic,
correct.
Though, eh? Absolute classic. What, we've lost? Yeah, you just lost, mate. Just caught the ball.
That is foolish. Although, this weekend, I should say, speaking of penalty runs, I had my first ever incident this is my 22nd season playing cricket. My first ever incident of 5 runs for hitting the helmet.
Did you?
It was entirely my fault. I was keeping wicket. The chap got an inside edge. I was going the other way, and the chap got an inside edge. So I had to. I was wrong footed. So I dived to get it and just flicked it onto the helmet, and they ran one. Hell of a 6.
That's a great 6, that. I used to clock those up all the time, mate. I used to clock them up like nobody's business.
Regularly.
So
yeah.
It was normally when a left-arm spinner was bowling into a rough on day 4 of a championship match or something, the ball would hit the rough and scuttle along the ground and go past underneath my gloves and clang into a helmet. So I used to try and find ways of moving the helmets out or in one game I just chose, but even before people were wearing helmets keeping wicket, I chose to wear it just to make sure I didn't let any 5 byes through.
Everybody looked at you askance, did they, when you did that?
I think they did, to be honest. And I also remember in that very same game, I was standing up to a seamer and we got, and the reason being was to try and get this lad LBW by forcing him back into the crease a bit. And we got him out LBW, and the next batter come in, so I thought I'd stand back to him. And so I stood back for 6 balls, and everybody's like going, "What are you doing?" And I still had the helmet on that I was keeping wicket in. dangerous standing back.
They do that a lot more in 2020 now, don't they? Just to save a bit of time, leave the helmet on.
Yeah, I don't think it makes a massive amount of difference, to be brutally honest with you, particularly with some of the lighter helmets that keepers wear. I don't think it makes too much of a difference. I certainly was oblivious to having it on. So,
yeah, those face masks as well. I mean, you know, it's just a grill, isn't it? Now with the
aero
ones. Yeah,
I'd wear that if I was still playing.
Right, let's wrap up this opening section with our usual yes-no round. All we get to do in this round is say yes or no. So Bernals will fire the questions at us, and me and Gareth will give us our yes or no answers.
First question. West Indies will win the ODI series against England.
Yes.
Yes.
Second question. IPL should have a window in the FTP.
Yes.
Yes.
Third question, Ian Bell should open the batting for England.
No.
I'm going to say yes, because I think you'll get it right now.
That's more than a one-word answer.
All right, yes. Go, Belly.
Right, let's dip into the mailbag now. And we've got a couple of questions this week which have a chance of winning a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. Plus, of course, Gareth and I will answer your questions in as much detail as we possibly can. So, Berners, what have we got this week?
First question comes in from Kern, and he's a tail ender, and he wants to know, when he goes into bat, what sort of frame of mind should he go to the crease with? For instance, if the team is batting first, then there's 15 overs left to bat, and as a number 9, he gets in there in that scenario, should he be looking to play his natural game, which in his case is to play a few shots, or should he be more defensive? Also, should his batting training be different to those of the top order players? If yes, how so?
Well, let me have a go at answering that one. Speaking as a tail-end batsman, I think it's a bit of a tricky one because it's not your main skill. So you're going to have less experience and less practice in that particular situation. And especially if you have a long time to bat as a tail-ender, you've got even less experience. But I think you should try and practice in the way that you expect to play. So if you know that your top order are not quite up to scratch and you think that perhaps you might be getting in with a few overs to go, then spend some time practicing playing out a little bit longer than the last three or four overs or whatever that you normally get to bat? I mean, obviously it depends on the game situation. If you're playing games where a draw is possible, you want to be able to have a solid enough defence and not be tempted by the spinner chucking the ball up where you think, we can get a few easy runs here. If you need to block out for the draw, then you've got to have that skill in you. You've got to have that solid defence in you. But I'd also think that you shouldn't necessarily hold back. It's you can get restricted by just thinking defensively. But also, it's a matter, I think, for playing as sensibly as you can within the given situation. Find the shots that you've got that you know that you can play well and stick to playing them. Nobody is going to expect you to do massively brilliantly. If you're batting at nine and there's 15 overs left in a 50-over match, no one's expecting you to play a brilliant innings. But if you're sensible, then you can do a good job for your team and maybe you can get through those 15 overs without either smacking one up in the air or playing around a straight one when you're trying to defend it.
Well, yeah, I think the role of 9, 10, 11 has changed significantly, isn't it, over the years. Whereas you used to get past number 7 in these teams and be expected just to the lower order to roll over. And now that's changed, and through the professionalism at the top end of the game, well, I see that very much down into the grassroots game as well, where people now actually practice as batters. If you're batting at number 10 and 11, you get some net time now, whereas you didn't used to. And maybe the thinking behind it, because we're seeing on telly now that people are winning games at number 9, 10 and 11. So it is, everybody's a run maker. Certainly everybody I work with, whether it's my number 1 or number 11, I'm looking to extract as many runs out of those guys as possible by giving them the best that I possibly can as a coach, and for them to give me their best as a run maker. And I don't call them batters here at Millfield. I call everybody a run maker, and I'm always asking them how many they've got in them today and making sure that their practice is all about trying to make runs. In terms of the whether you should bat, you know, aggressively or not, obviously you've got to take the consideration of the conditions, the match situation, who you're batting with, because it could be that you've got a guy who's in the 90s and you want to get him through to 100. We see that a lot in Test cricket. So you've got to take that into consideration. But I think the adage of batting is that you should always look to attack first and then work your way down through the levels of shots and decision making until you get to a lever or a block, but doing that with a very positive attitude, and it doesn't matter whether you're going number one and you're an Andrew Strauss or Chris Gayle or whatever the case may be, or whether you're a number 11, and that's where working with the likes of people like Jimmy Anderson, who turned himself into a really good number 11 batter, somebody who can be a night watchman, and even somebody like Monty, you know, the famous pictures of them at Cardiff holding out for that draw in 2009, which was absolutely crucial in England winning the Ashes. You know, that sort of thing, that mantra, I think, goes across into club cricket now, and number 11s are there to finish off games now, as opposed to be the blokes that just walk in and then walk back out again.
That's kind of why I like batting at 11. There's a bit of a running joke in our club that I'm the specialist number 11, because I'm probably a better batsman than some of the guys that go in above me. But because I've got the best defence out of probably 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, I know that if I need to go in with 5 overs to go and we need to block out to save the game, then I can just block everything no matter what. But I kind of like number 11, because you've either, especially in games where the draw is possible, you either just got to block everything or you've got to hit the last ball for 4 to win the game. That's pretty much the only two jobs that you're ever going to have as a number 11. So
yeah, definitely. And the other thing is that if you get in, it generally means that somebody or a lot of people have messed up, which provides an opportunity. Mm. And you've only got to look back at last week's Test match to see that, and somebody grasp their opportunity. You know, which comes back to being a run maker. And I'm sure that Tino Best, if he didn't think of himself as a run maker beforehand, will certainly do so now.
Well, he's got the confidence, hasn't he, Tino? So he probably did think of himself as a Test match number 7 anyway.
I should imagine he did.
I love the way he just smiles after every time he scores a run.
Yeah, quite right too.
That was incredible. I think what that shows is just how brilliant cricket is, because in no other sport do you see someone who is completely unequipped to perform at the elite level go against people who are of the highest standard and then succeed. Mm. You know, he's not. If we were selecting the 11 best batsmen from the West Indies, he wouldn't get a sniff, would he?
No.
But yet there he is, scoring 90. What was it? 96.
95
against the world's best bowling attack, and there's no other sport where you see that.
Minus two.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. These guys are elite athletes. He's not an elite batsman, and yet he did it. And that's, you know, I think that's probably the joy of cricket summed up in one thing for me.
Yeah, no, it was brilliant, wasn't it? And you're right. I think his attitude was the thing that gave him half a chance, you know. And he is a very positive bloke, too. You know, if you spend any time around him, he's bubbly, and also he's got a bit of batting in the family. And Carlisle Best was his uncle. Who could certainly bat, and you know, from a talent perspective, anybody that played against him in those years will rave about his talent. And he probably didn't give himself the best possible chance, but you know, Tino's obviously been brought up around that, and I thought he played some great shots, to be really honest. I was loving it, and I was listening to it on the radio at the time, and then watched the highlights afterwards. It was highly entertaining.
Well, the commentator made a good point. He said, "I don't think there's any single the only people in this whole world that wouldn't want him to get 100 right now, the 11 England players out there."
I reckon one or two of them would have been quite chuffed to have seen it, actually. as competitive as they are, in the context of the match at the time, with it being a shortened game and unlikely to get a full result out of it, you know, it would have been a I was there moment, I suppose.
I mean, it was so brilliant. It went past, watching it, it went past infuriating and just went into hilarious. And I think if you're on the pitch, that you must have had that feeling as well. You must just think to yourself, well, this is now so ridiculous, it's funny. I'm not even, you know, I'm not frustrated anymore. I'm just enjoying watching what he's doing. I mean, you obviously keep trying. But that must be the feeling that must go through your head when you're playing, because it certainly does when you're watching.
The next question is about ball shining, and Mr. Javier wants to know why it's so bad to shine the ball with sweat, and what else should he use? Well, Mr. Polish doesn't go far wrong, Mr. Javier.
Obviously, highly illegal, Berners, and you wouldn't be encouraging people to do that at all, would you? Sweat's a toughie. I mean, basically, a leather has got its own enzyme, but if you work with that own enzyme, it will shine up. The trouble with putting sweat into that is that the ball gets heavy, which in days gone by, people were believed that was one of the things that helped reverse sweat. But ideally, you want to keep the ball as dry as possible and use the natural characteristics of leather, which are underneath the surface of a ball when it's new, because obviously it's got a lacquer on it. Once you break that lacquer down, you can get into the leather, and the more you can shine it, the more you're likely to get the ball to move laterally in the air, either in a reverse fashion or in a conventional fashion in the early part of an inning. So, I would always look to keep the ball as dry as possible. Use spit maybe, or a little bit of spit just to smooth over an area of the ball that maybe got rough, just to get that down and then work on that again. But the name of the game is to keep the ball as dry as possible, really, and use the natural characteristics of leather to get that shine up, and then you'll start to see things happening.
Of course, the traditional thinking has always been, you know, you shine, get one side as shiny as possible, the other side you don't bother about it at all. The rougher, the better. Is that? Is that still the way that it's approached, that shining the ball? Just work hard on one side and let the other side deteriorate as quickly as possible.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, when it said works hard on one side, actually, when the ball gets to a certain condition where it's absolutely knackered, you only want to put a dome on the ball. And we used to talk about getting a 50p dome on the top of the ball when it was absolutely knackered in subcontinent condition, because you only need to have, say, a 50p, but right on the top of the dome of the ball to get that ball to trip over and then start to reverse swing. So it's not always about keeping one side perfectly shiny, because in a lot of people that are listening to this are going to be listening in the conditions where that's very, very difficult to do. And therefore, it's the dome of the ball that becomes really, really important rather than the whole of the shiner side of what the ball, which we would probably, particularly in our conditions that we've got presently in England, would be able to easily retain one side of a ball in good nick. And then obviously around the seam becomes really, really important on the shiny side. If you've got conditions to keep it in good nick, you work on that and keep flattening it down and really just rub as hard as you can. And I always try and encourage people to rub in a circular motion rather than just straight up and down. Because if you're doing straight up and down, then you tend to get a strip of shine on the ball, whereas if you rotate as you're shining, then you're getting the whole of the side of the ball being shined, and you're encouraging that dome motion.
Now, all the international teams now have shiners, you know, people who are specifically allocated that job. I know, certainly the talk is that England have Alistair Cook because he just doesn't sweat. How important is a shiner at lower levels, or is it more of a, you know, get the whole team involved in it?
No, I would always have a shiner, mate. Less hands on the ball, the better.
So how do you pick that person? Is there any science to it that somebody can do, or you just pick the one who's the most keen?
Well, I think keenness is massive, you know, because it's a role, isn't it? In the same way as short leg is a role, in the same way as slips are a role, it's something that you want to give somebody that they take pride in and do it properly. I think that keenness, the motivation to want to do it, and to take pride in what they're doing as well, because obviously if the ball's doing nothing and then you can get it working for 15 overs, and that's a massive bonus for the bowlers. So it is a role that will be valued as well. So definitely get somebody on. I mean, Alistair not sweating is a bonus because it keeps moisture off the ball, as we talked about earlier. But the key thing is there that he wants to do the role. He's done it really, really well. And his best mate Jimmy Anderson will probably agree with me on that one.
is there a better place for that shiner to be fielding?
Not really, because Cookie generally fields in positions away from slips nowadays, whereas Trez was did it from slip, and then we got the ball back to mid-off very quickly. Mid-off was generally the bowler who was bowling at the other end, or a bowler that was just about to come on, so obviously it's in their interest to keep the ball in good nick as well. So that was the way of doing it.
So just to think about the pattern of that, so generally it's sort of keeper to shiner to mid on or mid off if they're not, and then as quickly as possible from mid on and off to the bowler.
Yeah, absolutely right. As fewer hands as possible.
Brilliant. Okay. All right. So hopefully if you're listening to that, Javier, you can think about who's touching the ball and how much shining you're doing to get what you want it to do. Okay, let's do our soapbox. So every week, one of the members of the team gets a chance to rant about something or other that's burning on their mind. And this week it's Gareth. So over to you, Gareth, for the soapbox this week.
It's a bit of a personal rant, this one, actually, and something that I probably blamed on my lack of success quite a lot, but I'm suffering with it now, so I thought I'd come up with it, and that's hay fever. And it's normally happens to me in the early part of the season, but because of the weather that we've had being so damp, I'm picking it up in sort of middle of June now, which isn't particularly good. But I remember facing Damien D'Oliveira, who often got me out, actually, and that would surprise people because he wasn't noted as being a bowler. But I was suffering with hay fever so much, I went into bat and I sneezed as he let go of the ball, and as a result lost it completely, and got LBW in a championship match to him. Went back into the changing room, smashed the changing room up at Portsmouth, acted like a complete child, and basically stayed away from everybody for the rest of the day. But hay fever's my thing at the moment. I've got it presently, and it just reminded me of a bad day at Portsmouth one day.
That's just about the end of the show, but before we go, we just need to wrap up a few little things, and one of those, of course, is the competition winner. A chance to win a prize, an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So we had two questions this week. Kearns tail-end batting and Javier's shining the ball. So Gareth, which one did you prefer best?
I'm going to go for Javier shining the ball because it's something that does make a massive difference, but often is missed, particularly in the club game. And, you know, we've all got bowlers that can use a ball that can move laterally, and yet we probably don't give them enough chance because we don't get our systems into place for shining it. So I'm going to go with that one.
Congratulations, you win a prize, online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And if you have a burning coaching question that you want answered yourself, and also you want to win that prize, then now you can send your question in to us. And Berners, how would they do that?
Give us a call on 02088 167 691, or you can drop us an email at coach@pitchvision.com.
Our Facebook is Pitch Vision Academy, and our Twitter is at PV Cricket Coach. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes. Just go to iTunes, do your search for Pitch Vision Academy. You'll find us first up. And if you don't want to use iTunes, head over to pitchvision.com/academy. Click on the podcast link at the top, and it'll give you all the instructions on how to get the feed into any other device that you prefer. We got one more thing, which is our tail ender. And I don't know how well known this term is. I first heard it not that long ago, but it's swear word in it, so we'll edit that out. But of course, it's fig jam, which are you chaps familiar with? I suspect you might be.
I think it's named Garraway's friend, isn't it?
I was going to say I thought it originated about a certain Mr. Peterson.
Well, there's a few. I was looking it up before the start of the show, and there's a few people with that name. I think Phil Mickelson, the golfer, has also been given that moniker. So I'm not sure who it was given to first. But of course, Fig Jam is an acronym. The F, I'll let you work out for yourself. But the rest of it is, I'm good, just ask me, which certainly gives a certain arrogance to proceedings. But I guess it's just coming from super confidence, which is what all top sportsmen should have, really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely right. But I remember when that got labelled against KP. That was quite amusing. Gave us something to chuckle about.
Yes, exactly. So on that note, we'll leave it for this week. So until next time, we'll see you next week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Berners.
Cheers, lads.
Cheers, coach. Cheers, guys. We'll